This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our open clinic today. You can ask our doctor any question you want. And today we're discussing your digestive system. And in the studio with me, Dato' Dr. Mahendra Raj, a consultant gastroenterologist. So if you have a question for him, anything to do with your digestive system, give us a call. The number is 03-7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mahendra. How are you today?
I'm fine, Meera. Thank you for having me here again.
You know, very quickly, you want to just explain to us what makes up the digestive system?
Well, the digestive system basically consists of the gastrointestinal tract, which starts with the mouth, where food first enters the human body, and then the esophagus, which is that tube which connects the mouth to the stomach. And then from the stomach, food kind of passes into a long hollow tube called the small intestine, and that's where much of the work of the gastrointestinal system or the digestive system takes place. That's where food is broken up, digested, and then absorbed into the bloodstream and used for its various purposes. And then of the food which is not digested and absorbed, what we call the residue, then passes into the large intestine. From the small intestine, the residue passes into the large intestine, where water is reabsorbed, and what is then left behind is basically the feces or stool, which is stored in the colon, sometimes for a day or two, sometimes a little longer, depending on how often people go to the toilet to poo. And then this is then expelled periodically into the toilet bowl.
Okay, all right. So now we know how that process happens.
Just a little addition to that, but the digestive system is not just a gastrointestinal tract. There's the pancreas, there's a gallbladder, and there's a liver, all of which actually have a role to play in digestion. So when we talk about the digestive system, it's the gastrointestinal tract and the adjunct organs which also play a role in digestion.
Okay, so I remember we have a question. We had a question on a hepatologist. If there is no hepatologist, meaning you have any liver problems, then they are referred to a gastroenterologist. Yeah. Do you look after that area as well?
Well, that's an interesting question, Meera, because I'm actually quite involved with this issue. Well, basically, a gastroenterologist is a doctor who has got postgraduate qualifications in what is called internal medicine and then goes on to subspecialize in this field of gastroenterology. And most, if not all, gastroenterologists will also receive training in liver diseases. So every gastroenterologist will be expected to have a good hold or a good understanding of liver diseases and the management of liver diseases. Then after that, many gastroenterologists subspecialize in various fields. Some of them may decide that they want to do advanced endoscopy. Some of them may decide that they want to specialize in just the liver. And it's these people, basically people who have gone through the gastroenterology program and then decide that they want to subspecialize in liver, who generally become hepatologists. Now, sometimes people indicate their desire to do hepatology at a relatively early stage and may have a hepatology program. But even then, there are very few hepatologists who would not have had also concurrent basic training in gastroenterology.
Okay, so what would ensure a healthy digestive system? And then after that, you can tell me what it is that we're doing so wrong that the digestive system doesn't seem to be functioning as well as it should. And the reason I say there might be a problem is because there seem to be more gastroenterologists coming through the system.
Well, you know, Meera, first thing I have to say is that the fact that there are many gastroenterologists coming out might not be a reflection of the increase.
Really?
It may just be an indication of the progression of society. But you know what? Yes, you're right. There are certain gastrointestinal diseases which are far more common than they have been before. Certain cancers, such colon cancer, for example, is increasing in incidence. But by the same token, there are other cancers, such as gastric cancer, which is actually reducing in incidence over the years.
And why is that?
Well, that is because there's this bug called Helicobacter pylori, which lives in the stomach of millions of people. And that's the number one risk factor for gastric cancer. As we evolve in terms of standard of living and income, for some reason, the Helicobacter pylori incidence starts falling. It has been falling over the last few decades. And with this fall in the Helicobacter pylori incidence has also been a simultaneous fall in the incidence of gastric cancer. So not all cancers are increasing in incidence.
But, you know, colon cancer, colorectal cancer is, you know...
On the rise.
Absolutely.
On the rise. Yep. And you're right. The rise in colon cancer has probably got something to do with lifestyle.
And that's the most common cause of cancer amongst men in Malaysia?
Yes, it is. Among men, it's the number one.
Second in women.
Second in women. Yeah, absolutely. So it's very, very important. And second overall as well. So it's a very important cancer which has got major public health impact on society. And it's rising largely because, I think, of lifestyle changes. Many people have attributed the westernization of our diets to increasing colon cancer. Of course, in any disease, there are genetic factors. So if you have a strong family history, then you already have all the risk factors. And then the environmental factors, which include diet and other aspects of lifestyle, increases the risk.
You know, when you say westernization of our diet, I quite feel sorry for the people of the West because it's almost like an insult to their diets. Yeah. But what is it about the so-called Western diet that's not working well for us?
Basically, overall increased calorie intake is number one. Increased amounts of sugar, refined carbohydrates, probably also increased amount of meat being consumed. All these factors seem to play a role in increasing the risk, especially of colon cancer. And colon cancer has also been associated with being overweight. So the obesity epidemic is also running in parallel with the colon cancer epidemic. So obesity increases the risk not only of things which we commonly know of like diabetes and heart disease, but it's also been associated with an increase in colon cancer.
How do we take charge of our digestive health rather than just say it's because of the Western diet? I mean, how do we take charge?
Well, there are some things which are out with our control. What the genes we are born with is totally out of it. But yes, there are things that we can do. And obviously, diet and exercise are the two things which are in our control. Eating more vegetables, whole grains, moderate amounts of meat, a bit more fish. So all these things which are, you know, often advocated by many dietitians is the way to go. And getting enough exercise and keeping trim. I think that's what we can do.
Azman Dawood is asking, my gallbladder was removed recently. Is there any diet restrictions, any food that he needs to avoid?
Look, your gallbladder would presumably have been removed because it was an unhealthy and diseased gallbladder. So you're better off without your gallbladder than with your gallbladder. But you're
really?
Right. You see, okay. You know, many people, when they have gallbladder disease, they're very apprehensive about taking out the gallbladder. But unfortunately, if you have a diseased gallbladder, it does you more harm than good. The gallbladder stores bile. So one of the main functions of bile is absorption of fats and oils by the gastrointestinal tract. So some people who have a gallbladder operation find that they don't tolerate fatty, oily meals like other people do. So they may have a tendency to have to run to the toilet a little bit when they take an oily, fatty meal, all right? So it's a good thing to maybe just cut back on your oils and fats. But, you know, there's a wide variation on the degrees of tolerance. Some people have their gallbladder out and, you know, don't find it very much difference in what they were able to eat before, whereas some people are a bit more sensitive. So in general, I think if you have your gallbladder out, you might want to be a little bit more careful about oily, fatty foods. But, you know, that piece of advice probably goes for everybody. So it might be a good thing to have your gallbladder taken out.
Okay. So basically, fats and oil, if it affects you.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's probably all right.
Yeah.
Open Clinic with Dr. Mahendra Raj, a consultant gastroenterologist. We are discussing your digestive system. Give us a call if you have a question. It's 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have a question from somebody regarding coffee and soy.
Could drinking coffee with soy alternative improve the digestion?
Well, The straight answer to that would be no, all right, because it depends on what you mean by digestion. I mean, in strict scientific terms, digestion means breaking down of food and absorption of food. So there's no evidence that putting soy in your coffee as opposed to milk would improve digestion in any way, unless, of course, you have lactose intolerance. Lactose is a sugar which is found in milk and dairy products. And many people in Asia, especially people with Oriental heritage, tend to develop lactose intolerance as they grow older and go into adulthood, because there's an enzyme in the gut which kind of becomes less found in lower levels as you grow older. So people with lactose intolerance will get diarrhea and abdominal discomfort if they take milk or dairy. In these people, yes, probably drinking your coffee with soy may help, or taking lactose-free milk when it's available may help, or taking lactose enzymes, which is now found in a kind of medical form, medicinal form, may help digestion.
Okay, you know, there's a lot of talk about lactose intolerance, gluten intolerance.
Yes.
Are we overdoing this whole gluten-free diet and, you know, to stay away from lactose?
Lactose intolerance, I don't think we're overdoing. Many people have lactose intolerance and they'll know when they have lactose intolerance. They don't actually have to have sophisticated tests. Gluten intolerance, I think, yeah, has become a fashionable concept. Mm-hmm. And I think it is being overdone a little bit. You see, gluten is a protein found in wheat and certain other types of grains. And in the West, there's a quite common condition called celiac disease, where the body has a true allergy to that wheat protein. And people with celiac disease actually can become very ill when they take a gluten-based diet, such as wheat. And wheat is found in so many things, bread, cakes, whole lots of other things. So in this group of people, wheat is bad. And this is not just gluten intolerance, it's proper celiac disease. Whereas gluten intolerance is sometimes a term used a bit more widely beyond the patients who have true celiac disease. And these are people who believe or have the perception that they have symptoms such as abdominal pain or bloating or indigestion when they take wheat-based products. Now, most of these patients have a condition called irritable bowel syndrome, which is a very common condition. And people with irritable bowel syndrome can get symptoms which are triggered by various foods, including foods which contain gluten. But it may not be the gluten in the food which triggers their symptoms. It may be some other component of food which is also found in high levels in the same foods which contain gluten. So sometimes gluten may get bad publicity. There's a whole lot of food components which are basically short chain carbohydrates, and there's an acronym for it called FODMAPs, which I won't go into. There is emerging evidence that foods which contain high levels of these so-called FODMAPs may trigger IBS symptoms or irritable bowel syndromes, irritable bowel syndrome symptoms in patients who have it. And it just so happens that gluten is also found in the same foods. So it might not be the gluten which is causing the symptoms.
Are there other examples?
Of what?
The FODMAPs.
The word FODMAPs actually stands for very long. It's called fermentable oligo monodisaccharides and polyols. So it's a very chemical name.
Yes, it is.
All right. So nowadays, if you want to look up what the FODMAP content is in a certain type of food, like a certain vegetable or whatever, you can actually go online, key in FODMAPs. And one of the most reliable sites are probably the Monash University site, who are the first people to actually describe this. And you can have a list of vegetables which or other food which are either high in FODMAPs or low in FODMAPs. And if you have IBS, it may be worth a little experiment in at least temporarily taking foods which are low in FODMAPs and seeing whether they improve your symptoms.
Okay, we have a question from Alvin Lam. Alvin is saying, what is the scientific explanation with coffee in the morning and doing the number two right after? I have that relationship with coffee, but I'm not complaining.
Thank God for coffee.
I don't think Alvin is the only one.
I think half the world's population probably has.
Coffee has that sort of an effect.
Coffee has a has what we call a pro-motility effect, which means that it stimulates peristalsis in the gut. So when the coffee hits the stomach and it's absorbed, it causes stimulation or peristalsis of the colon, where the poo is stored. So that triggers an urge to go to the toilet.
Okay, we have a question from Sharifa Hanan. It's pretty much along the same lines, but you know, she's describing it a little differently. What does Sharifa have to say? Hi, Sharifa. Yeah.
Hi, doctor.
Hi, Sharifa.
Craving coffee, after a few hours, my hands start to shake and I get palpitation and also tummy ache and the number 2.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So you might have an undue sensitivity to the chemicals in coffee which cause this. I mean, obviously, caffeine is one of these things which kind of makes you a bit hyper and wakes people up. It could be that you're a little bit more sensitive than most people to the caffeine and maybe the other chemicals which are found in caffeine, in coffee. So while some people just may have the urge to go to the toilet in the morning, your urge might be a little bit exaggerated.
Okay, so it can happen depending.
Yes.
Then reduce the coffee and work it out. Sometimes it's just coffee can be strong. You have milder coffee as well.
So some people need a strong cup of coffee in the morning to go. Some people can manage with a light cup of coffee. So coffee, like any medicine, has to be given in the right dose. And fortunately, it's not a prescription medicine. So you have the liberty to experiment and find the right dose for yourself.
Okay. It's our open clinic with Dr. Mahendra Raj, consultant gastroenterologist. We're discussing your digestive system. We'll come back with more questions, one of which is whether or not we can cure bloating. Angin, we love that word. So that's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living. I'm Meera Sivasodhi, and in the studio with me, Dr. Mahendra Raj, a consultant gastroenterologist, and it's our open clinic. You can ask the doctor any question you want, and today's topic is on your digestive system. Dr. Mahendra has actually explained to us the
gastrointestinal tract.
That's right. It starts from the mouth to the esophagus, to the stomach, to the small intestine, the large intestine. But what we really forget is the pancreas, gallbladder and liver also are part of the digestive system. So if you have a question about any one of those, you can always give us a call, 7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us on BFM Radio. A lot of questions here on, the most common thing that we love is angin or bloating. I mean, is there really a cure for bloating? Maybe you can start with what really causes bloating.
If I could find a panacea, one medicine which cures all bloating, I think I'll be on the plane to Sweden for the Nobel Prize.
I have found it, Dr. Mahendra.
You have?
Yes.
Well, I think you should publish it. And I'll nominate you for the Nobel Prize.
You can find it in the market. I find ginger.
Ginger.
Makes a huge difference. Yeah.
You know, the problem with bloating is that it's a symptom. It's a sensation. It's a discomfort, which could mean different things to different people. To some people, bloating means pain. All right. To some people, bloating means a feeling that the abdomen is ballooned out. And many people would say, I feel bloated. And they have the perception that there's a larger volume of gas in the stomach and intestine than anybody else. The problem is, because it's a symptom, it can be an indication of many different conditions. It may not be caused by one disease. If there was one disease causing one symptom, then the answer would be simple. There'll be one medication. But bloating can be due to so many things. If you have gastroesophageal reflux, which means gastric juices from the stomach sometimes regurgitate back up into the esophagus, then one of the symptoms it can produce is bloating. If you have a condition called functional dyspepsia, where the nerves in the stomach are a little bit more sensitive than normal to the normal acid in the stomach or certain types of food which you ingest, that can cause bloating. If you have a condition called irritable bowel syndrome, where there are problems with the sensitivity of the nerves in the intestine, or in fact, problems with the motility or peristalsis of the intestine, that can cause bloating. And sometimes, if you have, so far I've mentioned conditions which are not that serious, sometimes if you have a sinister lesion such as a stomach cancer or a pancreatic cancer, you can have bloating too. So whenever you have a symptom like that, I guess if you see a doctor, the doctor's first duty is to take a very careful history. He'll ask you various things like, when do you get the bloating? Does anything particularly trigger it? Are you losing weight? And all that kind of... And after all of that, and the examination, there's some kind of formulation as to what is the most likely cause of the bloating. And that's when, if the doctor finds there's a very definite cause and there's treatment for it. Some conditions are easily treated with lifestyle changes. Like, for example, if you have reflux, there are certain lifestyle things, small meals, avoiding coffee and alcohol and oily, greasy foods, and not lying down after eating, taking medication to lower the acidity, all of that will help the bloating sensation. If you actually have an ulcer in the stomach, that's also easily treated. But if you have something like the so-called irritable bowel syndrome or functional dyspepsia, then treatment is not always so straightforward because there's no magic medicine. Some people respond to certain medicines and some people don't. Some people respond to certain lifestyle measures and some people don't. And stress and emotional triggers also play a big role in these kind of conditions. So there are always going to be some people who have troublesome recalcitrant bloating, which doesn't respond to any medicines. And sometimes it has to be a multimodality type of approach. You have to manage the stress. You have to try and find food which helps it and avoid foods which trigger it. And then sometimes with medication, it helps as well.
What about reflux and, you know, indigestion? Why is it some people are more prone to it?
Well, the short answer would be genetically, some people would be more prone to it because the little muscle ring at the lower end of the esophagus is a little bit weaker than normal, all right? But if you have that slight predisposition to it, then certain environmental factors aggravate it and certain lifestyle factors aggravate it. For example, if you have that little tendency for reflux and you have a devil-may-care attitude and you put on a lot of weight, then the reflux symptoms become more severe. And if you lose weight, the reflux symptoms become less severe. If you're consuming a lot of alcohol late at night, big pizza, huge can of beer, and then crashing out at night, that'll be a recipe for bad reflux. Whereas even if you have reflux, if you avoid all the lifestyle things which aggravate it, then you can control it to a large extent.
Okay, so really your answer is there is no cure for bloating unless you know what's causing
it. There's not always a cure for bloating, but if you have certain conditions with a very definite medication, it's curable.
Okay.
The more important thing is just to identify what's causing the bloating.
Okay. Johnny Chong is on the line and he has a question for us. Hi, Johnny.
Hello, doctor.
Hello, Johnny.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yes, I had some bloating on the colon for some time, about 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So recently I referred to the GH.
Yeah.
So they request I do a colon scope.
Sure.
The colonoscope department, they say there are some colon obstruction.
Oh.
So they refer me to the CT scan
right.
department.
Right.
So that after the CT scan done their job, so they say that it's only a polyps in the colon.
Mm.
So they refer me back to the colonoscope department.
Right.
So I have an issue here. Do you think that should I proceed with the colonoscope or should I, you know, go elsewhere? It seems that dilemma, right? The colonoscope, it goes to the CT scan.
Mm.
The CT scan send me back to the colonoscope.
Mm.
And I have to take that medicine to do the purging. It's very troublesome for me.
Johnny, just a very quick question. How old are you, Johnny, if you don't mind sharing that with the rest 58. Of the world?
Sorry?
58.
John, yes. If you've got abdominal symptoms at 58, then certainly the first thing is it must be investigated adequately. And I think you had a colonoscopy. You said you've already had a colonoscopy. Is that right?
He's gone off the air.
Oh. Yep. And if you've had a colonoscopy and there's any suggestion that there's colonic obstruction, then that's a very serious problem. I hope that there might have been a bit of misunderstanding or miscommunication and that you don't have true colonic obstruction. But if you have colonic obstruction, that certainly merits very urgent investigation with a CT scan and perhaps even a repeat colonoscopy. On the other hand, if you had polyps in the colon, and polyps are basically small growths in the colon, that may or may not be serious. If they're just small polyps, they have to be taken out because these small polyps have the potential to turn into cancer many years later. If they are very large polyps, then, and they cannot be taken out at endoscopy, you may need surgery. So my advice to you, Johnny, would be to engage the doctors who have been managing you and get a clear idea as to whether they really mean that you have obstruction of the colon or not. If you have, then that is something which merits urgent attention.
More than the polyps?
Yes.
Okay. It's our open clinic with Dr. Mahendra Raj, consultant gastroenterologist. We're discussing your digestive system. Phone lines are open. You can call and ask him any question you want. It's 7733 2900. WhatsApp 018 789 8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have another question here on how to improve your gastric with time. And this is what the question is.
Hello, my name is Kat. Can common gastric problems decrease with healthy eating over time?
Well, it depends on what gastric problems. Kat, I think you said it. The problem with the word gastric, Kat, is that the word gastric actually means stomach. So all of us have stomach, all of us have gastric. But what the common layperson means by gastric is discomfort. So when they say, I've gastric, doctor, what the doctor knows is that what you're complaining to him is discomfort in the abdomen. The problem is the same as bloating. That discomfort can be due to many causes. If the cause of that discomfort or so-called gastric is gastroesophageal reflux, then the answer is yes, lifestyle changes can make a big difference. On the other hand, if that gastric so-called is due to, say, certain types of painkillers, what we call non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, then that can be cured too by stopping those painkillers and taking medication to lower the acidity and heal ulcers. If it's an ulcer in the stomach, it can be cured. But on the other hand, if that so-called gastric is due to this condition called functional dyspepsia, where the nerves in the stomach are a little bit sensitive, it may not be as easy to cure once and for all permanently. And in that kind of condition, medicines may help, but other things like stress management, managing emotional problems and relationships, work, all that kind of thing might have a kind of joint benefit as opposed to taking one medicine.
Or another question on spicy food and how that, you know, I mean, we love our spice now, yeah, don't we? I mean, unfortunately, some people can't take spicy food.
Yes.
I like spicy food, but when I take it extremely spicy, sometimes I get heartburns that last almost the whole day.
Yep.
What can I do about this?
Yeah. I'm not going to say to you, don't take spicy food.
Living in Malaysia.
Because living, living one people. And, you know, the thing about spices is that in themselves, the chili and the various spices don't harm the gut. They don't blow holes in your stomach. They don't erode the lining of your stomach or anything. It's just that if you have certain conditions, such as gastroesophageal reflux, it increases the discomfort. Because you can imagine, number one, many spicy things also come in foods which have a lot of oil. And if you take oily foods, you will have a greater tendency for regurgitation of the gastric contents into the esophagus. And if this regurgitation also has a little bit of chili and spices in it, then that could aggravate some of that burning sensation in your lower chest. So it's not that it harms you, it's just that it increases tendency for reflux. So if you like spicy food and you have reflux, then manage the reflux as best you can. Eat smaller volume meals. Don't take a huge spicy curry at 12 o'clock at midnight and then go to bed straight away. Have your curry in modest quantities at 7 o'clock in the evening. If you need to, have some antacids after that, wait a good 2-3 hours, and then go to bed with your head a little bit high so that it doesn't regurgitate into your esophagus.
Okay. Question here via WhatsApp. My son is 5 years old. He takes daily intake of vegetables, fruits, yogurt, and sufficient water. He suffers from constipation. Is that related to gut health?
That's a difficult question because it all depends on what you mean by gut health. Look, some people are more prone to constipation than others. Again, we don't know why. There are certain genetic factors, obviously. And of course, there are some people who just don't eat enough fruit and vegetables, and therefore the constipation is directly attributable to poor lifestyle. But there's some poor people who do all the right things. They eat enough fruit and vegetables, they drink enough water, they exercise, and yet can suffer from very troublesome and almost disabling constipation. In these patients, there could be a problem with the motility or movements of the colon. There could be a problem with actually sometimes just having an urge to go to the toilet. There could be a problem with the muscles in the pelvis, which have to relax before you have a poo. There could be a problem with the muscle sphincter, or that muscle sphincter at the end of the rectum and the anus, which doesn't relax as easy. So there could be a multitude of things which cause constipation. In this group of people who have severe constipation, despite doing all the right things, then the right thing to do is to see a doctor. Sometimes seeing a doctor, doing some tests, and then unfortunately going on medication can help relieve symptoms.
Okay, when is constipation a sign of a more serious problem?
Well, firstly, if you're older, and the definition of old can vary variable, of course, but certainly after the age of 40, especially, and if it is of recent onset, that means, you know, you've always had regular bowel habits, but in the last 2-3 months, suddenly you've become a bit more constipated, then that could be worrying. If it's associated with other slightly more serious symptoms, for example, if you've noticed blood in your poo, or if you're losing weight, or you're getting pain which actually disturbs your sleep and keeps you awake at night, then all of that could indicate something far more serious.
Okay. I'm very upset you said older, 40 and above, Dr. Mahendra.
Yeah.
40 and above?
Well, you know, there's when doctors talk about doing investigations on patients, often they think about 40 as a kind of arbitrary figure where after that, everything just gets a little bit more worrying.
Thank you very much for that. Do you think that age has actually dropped to 40 now? I mean, that seems pretty young.
Yeah, you know what? The problem is this. We're talking, say, specifically about constipation. Colon cancer starts increasing in incidence from about the age of 50 or so. Nowadays, unfortunately, in certain Asian populations, we're seeing patients who are much younger, 45 or so. But it's very unusual to see people, not unknown, but it's very unusual to see patients with colon cancer below the age of 40. So we would generally take these symptoms more seriously in patients who report it after the age of 40.
Okay, we'll do a quick market update and come back. I want to know whether or not we are overdoing colonoscopies. Are we unnecessarily doing this? And also a question on coconut oil. There's a question here on coconut oil and whether that helps with the digestive system, as well as the intermittent fast, whether that has any benefit at all to the gut health. Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, it's Health and Living. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. If you have just joined us, it's our open clinic with Dr. Mahendra Raj, consultant gastroenterologist. We are discussing your digestive system, right from the mouth all the way down to your large intestine, to your pancreas, your gallbladder, as well as your liver. All of that makes up your healthy or your digestive system. So we've covered quite a lot of ground, actually, Dr. Mahendra. If you have a question, once again, the number to call us, 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Before we left off, I wanted to ask you whether or not we are overdoing colonoscopies. Are people unnecessarily carrying out this sort of procedure?
The simple answer to that is yes or no. There are certain segments of the population who have no access to colonoscopy. And then there are other segments of the population where colonoscopies are clearly being overdone. The first thing to realize is that there's no question. Doing a once-in-a-lifetime screening colonoscopy, that means you're doing a colonoscopy on a healthy individual with no symptoms at all, at the age of 45 or 50, depending on which country you live, can save lives, because it's good evidence that it will reduce the risk of colon cancer. And because of this, a lot of work and research has been done on the role of colonoscopies in detecting precancerous and early colon cancer. And there are very well-defined guidelines on the use of colonoscopy. If you have a first-time colonoscopy at the age of 50 and you don't have a strong family history of colon cancer and you don't have any polyps in the colon, you don't need another colonoscopy for at least 5 to 10 years. On the other hand, if you have polyps in the colon, depending on the number and the size of the polyps, you may need follow-up colonoscopies in 3 to 5 years. So doctors who do colonoscopies should be aware of these guidelines, and perhaps people who go for colonoscopies should also be aware that there are guidelines and should engage their doctors in a conversation about these guidelines before subjecting them to colonoscopy. So if you're a healthy 40-year-old with no polyps and you go along to do a colonoscopy every year when you take your blood sugar or your blood cholesterol, that is grossly inappropriate. But if you have a colonoscopy at the age of 50 and you have a polyp which has been removed completely and then you're recommended to have another colonoscopy in 5 years, that's appropriate. So I think colonoscopies are being overdone, unfortunately, and that's a conspiracy between sometimes demanding patients and sometimes unscrupulous doctors. And it shouldn't happen because the guidelines are very well and clearly defined.
And you would only know you have a polyp if you do a colonoscopy?
Absolutely right.
Okay. Yep. What are your thoughts on tumour markers? Because we know we do blood tests and, you know, there's a lot of screening going on. Yeah. And sometimes tumour markers could indicate something not terribly right with the digestive system.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation about tumour markers. Many tumour markers, which are essentially blood tests, are part and parcel of a general health blood screening. And they are inappropriate because they are not perfect tests. There are many false positives, which means there may be a slight elevation in your tumour marker level and you have no cancer. And as a result of that, you go through a whole gamut of unnecessary investigations. By the same token, you may have an early cancer. You could have a breast cancer or a colon cancer and not have an abnormal tumour marker. So tumour markers alone are mostly inappropriate as a screening tool, with one or two little exceptions. For example, there's a tumour marker called alpha fetoprotein. If you already have a chronic liver disease, then using that tumour marker in conjunction with an ultrasound every 6 months is of reasonable value in screening for early liver cancer. But even then, the tumour marker alone is inadequate.
But do you not think that it could be used as a baseline reading?
No, I don't think so.
Not at all?
No. It's arguable whether using these tumour markers is good or bad, you know, because firstly, it can encourage a false sense of security. People with very serious symptoms, I mean, these are people not who are just going for health screening, but people with very serious symptoms sometimes do a whole set of blood tests. The tumour markers are normal, and they sink into a false sense of security, thinking, oh, doctor, I'm fine. My tumour markers are fine. So I couldn't have cancer, and they could be grossly wrong. And then the healthy people with just a very slightly elevated tumour marker who then come in for a whole bunch of tests, which is also probably not right. The only time the tumour markers are of value is if at the beginning, for some reason, they're extraordinarily high. The levels are in the hundreds or thousands, so much so that it's very likely that you have a cancer. Or the main role for tumour markers is really in people who already have cancer. And it's used as a measure of whether or not you're responding to the cancer and whether the cancer has recurred. Tumour markers were essentially designed for that, not as primary screening tools in patients, in people, not patients, people with no symptoms.
Coconut oil. What are your thoughts on coconut oil and the digestive system?
I wouldn't have a huge opinion on that. I mean, look, coconut oil is a vegetable oil. It's shown to be of some value. But like anything, as far as food is concerned, small to moderate amounts is good. Right? It's a vegetable oil, so it doesn't have high cholesterol and things like that. So I wouldn't be a major advocate of drinking large quantities of coconut oil every day. But I think using a little bit of coconut oil in your cooking can't be a bad thing.
Intermittent fasting, does that do any good for the digestive system?
I think there's reasonable evidence that intermittent fasting can be a fairly efficient way of losing weight. So if you're overweight to begin with and you lose weight, that has an indirect beneficial effect on the on digestive health, I guess. You reduce the risk of cancer and other things. Whether or not it alters the physiology of the gastrointestinal tract, I think is unknown. And I don't think there's any strong evidence that it does that in any beneficial or detrimental way. But the thing about intermittent fasting, of course, is that I don't think it's something which can be used in the long term in a sustained way to lose weight. It may help kickstart some people to losing weight, but in the end, to maintain a healthy weight is a more long-term thing which involves just eating less and exercising more.
Okay. I have a question here from Wisely Tay. He's saying his wife relies on an enema to pass motion. She just can't do it naturally. What can she do to not rely on the enema?
You know, if she's been using an enema very regularly, and I presume for a long time, and assuming that she has already, I don't know how old she is, but assuming that she's already been seen by a doctor and investigated and any potentially sinister disease has been excluded, then it'll be unlikely that she will be able to actually pull on her own without some kind of help. If an enema, if she's kind of averse to using an enema every day, then she would probably need some form of oral laxatives. It could be a tablet, it could be a liquid, but it's probably unlikely that she's going to be able to poo. This is a fairly small group of people, but it's probably unlikely that she'll be able to poo without the help of some kind of medicine. And so eat enough fruits and vegetables, drink enough water, but at the same time, if you're getting no joy despite all of this, then I think some form of medicines is inevitable. And there are laxatives which are fairly safe, which can be taken long-term if they have to be, and they can be taken orally.
You know, you've spoken quite a lot about different types of digestive health issues. You've spoken about irritable bowel syndrome. You've spoken about celiac disease. You've spoken about constipation. Which one of it do you think worries you more, most of all? And you've also spoken about the cancers, right?
In terms of worry, of course, it's the cancers which are the most worrying because they have the most devastating impact on your life expectancy and your quality of life. So constipation is a worry if it happens in a 70-year-old auntie who has been bothered with constipation in the last 2-3 months, because immediately the first thing on your mind is, has this poor old auntie got colon cancer? If it's something which has been going on for years in a 40-year-old and it's impacting on quality of life, it's not a worry, but I feel sorry for these people because they have a terrible quality of life. So it's more a concern, it's more sympathy for than a worry. Constipation, someone who just doesn't like to eat vegetables, has less sympathy from me because that could be correctable, you know, eating more vegetables and fruit. So it depends really on the context. In terms of condition, celiac disease is potentially a serious condition.
Is that quite common in Malaysia?
It's very uncommon in Malaysia. Fortunately, it's very uncommon in the Asian population. It is not exclusively, but largely a Caucasian disease.
Okay. And if you could generally tell us what are some of the common signs that there is something wrong with our digestive system?
Symptoms, obviously abdominal discomfort is a symptom. Loose motions, recent constipation or recent change in bowel habits, vomiting, persistent nausea, any blood in the stool, weight loss, unexplained weight loss, difficulty swallowing, food getting stuck in your esophagus. These are all what we would call red flag symptoms. And red flag symptoms mean you have to go to your doctor straight away and be assessed carefully because there could be something serious lurking inside.
Okay, so your message on how to maintain a healthy, healthy digestive system.
Look, eat sensibly. The old wisdom, fresh fruit and vegetables in abundant quantities, whole grains in appropriate quantities, moderate amounts of meat, eat small to moderate-sized meals, don't overdo it. I think that's the basic message.
Do you think people are even listening?
I think many people are listening, but sometimes temptations can't be overcome.
Mm-hmm. And do you find it's often late that we want to change our habits?
Often it is. Often it is. See, when you're young and slim and active, the incentive to eat healthily is the least. And then when you're kind of overweight and you've already got the diabetes and you've got the GI problems, it's never too late, but it's sometimes harder.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us today. That was Dr. Mahendra Raj, consultant gastroenterologist in our open clinic on your digestive system on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.